This is an Audio Renaissance production of On the Trail of the Assassins, My Investigation and Prosecution of the Murder of President Kennedy. Written by Jim Garrison. Adapted for audio by Richard O'Connor. Produced by Bill Hartley. Narrated by Edward Esner. Because On the Trail of the Assassins is a personal account by Jim Garrison of his investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, it is written in the first person. To preserve the immediacy and personal impact of Mr. Garrison's account of his investigation, Audio Renaissance presents the work as written, as a first-person narrative. The thoughts and words of Mr. Garrison are narrated by Edward Esner.
My name is Jim Garrison. And this is a chronicle of my experiences. Of one man who tried to get to the truth about the murder of President John F. Kennedy and prosecute those responsible for it. I speak not as a critic, but as a participant, a prosecutor, and an investigator. At the time of the assassination on November 22, 1963, I was district attorney of New Orleans. Because the accused assassin Lee Harvey Oswald had resided in New Orleans the summer before the assassination, I was immediately drawn into the case. More than 3 years later, in March of 67, my investigation culminated in the arrest of Clay Shaw. He was director of the International Trade Mart and a fixture in New Orleans high society. The charge was conspiracy to murder John Kennedy. In the months leading to Shaw's trial in 1969, I publicly suggested that members of the U.S. government's intelligence community, including Shaw, were responsible for the assassination. And they had carried it out in order to stop President Kennedy's efforts to break with Cold War foreign policy. While the jury accepted my argument that there had been a conspiracy, it was not then aware of Shaw's role as a clandestine CIA operative. Unconvinced of his motivation, the jury acquitted him of the charges. History has a way of changing verdicts. 25 years ago, most Americans readily accepted the government's contention that the assassination was a random act of violence. It stated that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lonely young man whose mind was steeped in Marxist ideology. The official version went on to say that this lone gunman had crouched at a warehouse window and, in 6 seconds of world-class shooting, destroyed the President of the United States. But time has undone the official explanation that most Americans at first believed. By 1967, two-thirds of the public did not accept the conclusion that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin. In the 70s, the new Freedom of Information Act opened doors. Material that federal agencies had secreted became available to the public. Since that time, able critics have done considerable research. Yet much of this information remains unknown to the majority of Americans. For example, 5 days before the assassination, the New Orleans FBI office received a telexed warning that an attempt would be made to assassinate the president. The Bureau did not pass on the warning to the Secret Service or other authorities. Shortly after the assassination, the telex message was removed from the file drawer of the New Orleans office of the Bureau. The great majority of witnesses at Dealey Plaza in Dallas heard repeated rifle fire coming from the grassy knoll in front of Kennedy. In the chase that followed, the Dallas police apprehended 3 men and marched them away under shotgun arrest. However, the numerous news photographs of their arrest were never published, and no record remains of their mugshots, their fingerprints, or their names. On the day of his arrest, Lee Oswald was given a nitrate test. The results showed that he had not fired a rifle in the previous 24 hours. This fact was kept secret by both the federal government and the Dallas police for 10 months. For more than 5 years, the film of the assassination taken by eyewitness Abraham Zapruder was concealed from the public. This moving picture showed Kennedy being slammed violently backwards. Clear evidence of his being struck by a rifle shot from the front. Approximately an hour before the arrival of Kennedy's motorcade, Jack Ruby was observed alongside the grassy knoll, unloading a man carrying a rifle in a case. Ruby was the man who later murdered Lee Oswald. A statement of Julia Ann Mercer, the witness to that event, was altered by the FBI. That alteration made it appear that she had been unable to identify Ruby. This fraudulent revision has never been explained or even denied by the federal government. After the president's body was subjected to a military autopsy, his brain disappeared. The brain, which is still missing after 25 years, had been immersed in formalin to harden it and might have shown from what directions the headshots had come from. Photographs and x-rays of the autopsy, which might also have resolved the issue, were never examined by the Warren Commission. Such revelations did eventually force the House Select Committee on Assassinations to conduct another investigation from 1976 to 1979. Its official conclusion was that there probably had been a conspiracy to murder President Kennedy, and that more than one man had been shooting at him. However, the investigation was limited and made no further attempt to determine the forces behind the assassination. At the end of this tape, I offer an informed historical speculation about what happened, who killed John Kennedy, and why. I do not claim, however, to have all the answers about the assassination. No individual could. To uncover the whole truth would require an open-ended, honest federal investigation, the kind that has not taken place to date. I was working at my desk in criminal court as district attorney of New Orleans when my chief assistant, Frank Klein, rushed in. "The president has been shot," he yelled. It was just past 12:30 p.m., Friday, November 22nd, 1963. The information coming from the television was inconclusive. Then, well into the middle of the afternoon, the arrest of the accused assassin suddenly was announced. Approximately 15 Dallas police officers had caught him while he was seated in a movie theater a considerable distance from the assassination scene. His name was Lee Harvey Oswald. While Frank Klein and I were transfixed by the TV, a most unusual incident occurred at Guy Bannister's office about 12 blocks away. Bannister was a former special agent in charge of the Chicago office of the FBI and a former deputy superintendent of police in New Orleans. Bannister and I had lunch together now and then, swapping colorful stories about our earlier careers in the FBI. That day, Bannister had been in the company of Jack Martin, a sometime private detective and hanger-on at Bannister's office. Both had been drinking. Martin made an injudicious observation, informing Bannister that he had not forgotten certain unusual things that had been happening at Bannister's office during that summer. At this point, Bannister whipped out his .357 Magnum pistol and began to massage Martin's head with it. In a minute or two, Martin was converted into a bloody, battered mess, and he was carted off to the hospital. That explosive act by Guy Bannister ultimately would lead to the only prosecution ever brought in the case of President Kennedy's murder. Later, Jack Martin confided to a friend what he had hinted at to Guy Bannister. His suspicion that David Ferry, an associate of Guy Bannister's, had driven to Dallas on that fateful day to serve as the getaway pilot for the men involved in the assassination. Although I personally had no argument with the official lone assassin scenario, I was not free to ignore Lee Harvey Oswald's unexplained 3 months in New Orleans, a connection that meant my office had to inquire into Oswald's possible associations in our jurisdiction. In the course of checking out all possible associates of Oswald's in the city, we discovered that the alleged assassin had been seen during the summer with a man named David Ferry. I had met David Ferry once. The encounter had been casual but unforgettable. One day I was about to cross the street when a man grabbed me by both arms. The face was like a ghoulish Halloween mask. The eyebrows were grease paint, one noticeably higher than the other. A reddish homemade wig hung askew on his head. I remember him congratulating me on my recent election as DA and mentioning that he was a private investigator. The name of David Ferry was well known in New Orleans. His reputation was one of an adventurer and pilot. He'd been involved in the abortive 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, and he made frequent speeches to veterans groups about patriotism and anti-communism. One of my assistant DAs, Herman Coleman, learned that Ferry had made a journey to Texas on the very day of the assassination. The source was the man to whom Jack Martin had confided after he had been pistol-whipped by Guy Bannister. Martin had told this source of his dark suspicions about Ferry's sudden Texas trip. I sent Chief Assistant DA Frank Klein and a team of investigators to Ferry's apartment, where they found an assortment of army rifles, ammunition clips, military canteens, and on the wall a large map of Cuba. Also, there were two young men awaiting Ferry's return. They said Ferry went to Texas in his car early Friday afternoon, approximately an hour after the assassination. This meant that Ferry probably had not been a getaway pilot, as Jack Martin believed. But it did not mean that we could regard him as clear of any connection with the assassination. On Monday morning, Ferry appeared and was brought to my office for questioning. He denied ever having known Lee Oswald, but admitted that he had driven to Houston early Friday afternoon. He said he had gone there to go ice skating. Later, we would learn that at the skating rink, he had never put on ice skates and had spent all of his time at a pay telephone, making and receiving calls. We also learned later that Ferry continued on from Houston to Galveston, where he happened to be when Jack Ruby called there, the night before he shot and killed Lee Oswald. Further investigation was necessary, so he was held in jail for questioning by the FBI. I was confident that an FBI investigation of David Ferry and any other matters even remotely related to the president's murder would be exhaustive. That faith probably was typical of most Americans in 63. However, it was particularly strong in my case because of my background. I had spent 5 years in the Army in World War II and another 18 years as a field artillery officer in the National Guard. Upon my return to civilian life, I followed my family tradition and went to law school at Tulane, obtaining both bachelor and master degrees. Shortly thereafter, I joined the FBI as a special agent in Seattle and Tacoma. I was very impressed with the competence and efficiency of the Bureau. However, I was extremely bored, so I decided to return to the law profession. I was elected and took office as district attorney in 1962. I brought to the city a truly independent DA's office. There was not a single political appointment on my staff. I was 43 years old and had been DA for 21 months when John Kennedy was killed. I was an old-fashioned patriot, a product of my family, my military experience, and my years in the legal profession. I could not imagine then that the government ever would deceive the citizens of this country. Accordingly, when the FBI released David Ferry with surprising swiftness, implying that no evidence had been found connecting him with the assassination, I accepted it. Nearly 3 years passed. By this time, our military was deeply engaged in the war in Southeast Asia. Like most Americans, I took it for granted that our government had our troops over there to bring democracy to South Vietnam. That was my view in late 66. I was happily married, father of three children, with two more to come. I had a great job and was quite content with the way my life was going. Then one day I had a chance conversation with Russell Long, the United States Senator from Louisiana. The subject of Kennedy's assassination arose. He said in his blunt fashion, "Those fellas on the Warren Commission were dead wrong. There's no way in the world that one man could have shot up Jack Kennedy that way." This was the first sign I had encountered that doubts persisted about Kennedy's assassination in such high quarters. The force of Senator Long's words aroused my curiosity. I immediately ordered the entire set of the Warren Commission volumes, the hearings, the exhibits, and the commission's report. While I waited for the books to arrive, I did some research at the library about how the Warren Commission had come into being. President Lyndon Johnson announced that he had formed a commission and chosen seven members. He had included two representatives from the Senate and House. The Warren Commission was weighted with men whose backgrounds were pro-intelligence or pro-military. Alan Dulles had been director of the CIA for 9 years. Representative Gerald Ford was described by Newsweek as the CIA's best friend in Congress. Senator Richard Russell chaired the Senate Armed Forces Committee. John J. McCloy had served as Assistant Secretary of War. Rounding out the commission were Chief Justice Earl Warren, Representative Hale Boggs of Louisiana, and Senator John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky. When the 26 Warren Commission volumes arrived, I immersed myself in the testimony and exhibits for some weeks. Considering the credentials of the commission members and the quality and size of the staff available to them, I'd expected to find a thorough and professional investigation. I found nothing of the sort. The mass of information was disorganized and confused. The commission had provided no adequate index to its exhibits. The number of promising leads that were never followed up offended my prosecutorial sensibility. And perhaps worst of all, the conclusions in the report seemed to be based on a selective reading of the evidence, ignoring testimony from dozens of witnesses. The commission officially concluded, for example, that Kennedy's murder was accomplished by one man shooting from behind the president. Yet I discovered early on in my reading that the statements of many of the witnesses at Dealey Plaza did not support that explanation. At the time the president was hit, the Texas School Book Depository, from which the Warren Commission claimed Oswald did all of the shooting, was well behind him to his right rear. Up in front of him on the right was the grassy knoll with a wooden picket fence, creating a small stockade. There was a grove of small trees clustered along the picket fence. Also on the right front, but slightly closer to the president, was a concrete arcade. All of this was on a terrace high atop the grass-covered slope overlooking the parade route. A number of witnesses vividly recalled noticing strange activities taking place in the grassy knoll area around the time of the shooting. For instance, an hour before the assassination, Julia Ann Mercer was driving past the grassy knoll on Elm Street. Caught in a traffic jam, she found herself stopped alongside a pickup truck parked partway up the curbing. She saw a young man with a rifle in a case dismount and clamber up the steep incline onto the knoll. She reported this to the FBI's local office and the Dallas Sheriff's office. Strangely, Julia Ann Mercer was never questioned by the commission's staff. Also, Lee Bowers, the switchman for the railroad yard, had a box seat view of the grassy knoll from his glassed-in tower, 14 feet above the yard. A few minutes before the shooting began, he observed two men standing behind the picket fence on the knoll, watching the approaching parade. Earlier, he had also seen an unfamiliar man driving a car around in the railroad yard behind the knoll. The man appeared to be speaking into a handheld microphone. Contrary to the Warren Commission's conclusions, some witnesses not only heard shots coming from the picket fence, but they also saw smoke from rifle fire drifting up through the trees. An even larger number had the impression that men had run from the knoll after the shooting, heading into the railroad yard behind. S.M. Holland, the signal supervisor for the Union Terminal Railroad, described the shooting this way, quote, "I counted four shots and a puff of smoke came out about 6 or 8 feet above the ground, right out from under those trees," end quote. Billy Lovelady, an employee of the book depository, was having lunch on its front steps. He recollected the shots came from, as he said, quote, "right there around that knoll," end quote. Abraham Zapruder, who became famous for the home movie he took of the shooting, was standing on the grassy knoll with his back to the picket fence. He described police officers running past him, adding, quote, "I also thought it came from back of me," end quote. William Newman, a Dallas design engineer, had been watching the parade with his family from the curb at the bottom of the knoll. Newman said, quote, "We were standing on the edge of the curb looking at the car as it was coming toward us. All of a sudden, there was a noise. The president jumped up in his seat. By this time, he was directly in front of us. I was looking directly at him when he was hit in the side of the head. I thought the shot had come from the garden directly behind me. I do not recall looking toward the book depository. I looked back in the vicinity of the garden. End quote. Malcolm Summers, the owner of a local mailing service, recalled the moment when the shooting ended. He said, quote, "Then all of the people started running up the terrace. Everybody was just running around towards the railroad tracks, and I knew that they had someone trapped up there." End quote. One lady, Jean Hill, actually chased one of the men. She admitted that she was not sure what she would have done had she caught up with him. She testified that she saw the man go, quote, "toward the railroad tracks," end quote. According to Hill's account, the railroad yard was clearly the destination of the men running from the assassination scene. I went back again to the testimony of Lee Bowers, the switchman in the train yard. He said, quote, "A large number of people came from more than one direction, between 50 and 100 policemen within a maximum of 3 minutes. They sealed off the area, and I held off the trains until they could be examined, and there were some transients taken from at least one train," end quote. Sergeant D.V. Harkness was the officer in charge of searching the departing trains. He testified, quote, "I was assigned to go down and search all freight cars that were leaving the yard. We pulled some people off and took them to the station. We made some arrests of hobos and tramps. They were questioned, but no guns were found," end quote. Remarkably, neither at the Dallas Sheriff's Office nor at the Dallas Police Department was there any record of their arrest or questioning, nor was there any mention of their names anywhere in the 26 Warren Commission volumes. Also never followed up was equally intriguing evidence indicating that there may have been men impersonating Secret Service agents around the railroad yard area. Joe M. Smith was a traffic officer at the intersection of Elm and Houston Streets. He was told by a woman that the shooting was coming from the bushes. He said, quote, "There was one Secret Service man when I got there. I had pulled my pistol from my holster, and as I was putting it back, he showed me that he was a Secret Service agent," end quote. However, according to the Warren Commission report, all of the Secret Service agents assigned to the parade had gone to the hospital. The Secret Service was on record that not a single one of its agents was at the scene of the assassination, other than those in the motorcade itself. And all of them were gone in minutes. This meant either that the Secret Service was lying or mistaken, or that the man Officer Smith encountered was not really a Secret Service agent. Even before his search of the railroad yards, Sergeant T.V. Harkness had gone to the rear of the book depository. He said, quote, "There were some Secret Service agents there. I didn't get them identified. They told me they were Secret Service agents," end quote. Apparently, then, there was not just one, but a number of people purporting to be Secret Service agents in an area where supposedly there were none. The Warren Commission had simply dropped the matter. The Dallas Police Department also conducted a highly irregular inquiry. After his arrest, Lee Harvey Oswald was questioned while in the custody of Captain Will Fritz, head of the Homicide Division. A recording of such questioning is routine, even in minor felony cases. Yet, the alleged murderer of the President of the United States had been questioned for a total of 12 hours without any taping or shorthand notes by a stenographer, nor was any attorney present. The absence of any record of the interrogation of Oswald revealed a disregard for basic constitutional rights that was foreign to me. A police officer of 30 years' experience like Captain Fritz had to be aware that anything Oswald said under such circumstances would be inadmissible in any subsequent trial. The more I read, the clearer it became that all the official investigations had systematically ignored evidence that might lead to a conclusion other than Lee Oswald being the lone assassin. I found myself reviewing the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Allison G. Folsom, Jr., reading from Oswald's training record. He described a grade that Oswald had received in a Russian examination at El Toro Marine Base in California. My ears went up. Oswald was assigned to anti-aircraft duty. A soldier genuinely involved in anti-aircraft duty would have about as much use for Russian as a cat would have for pajamas. This was the first indication that Lee Oswald, in 1959 at least, had been receiving intelligence training. I knew, as did anyone with military background, that Marine intelligence activity was guided by the Office of Naval Intelligence. I wondered what possible connection there might have been between ONI and Lee Harvey Oswald. The next morning, I headed downtown to 544 Camp Street. This address had been imprinted with a small hand stamp on literature Oswald had been handing out on the streets of New Orleans in the summer of 63. Oswald had been spotted participating in several pamphleting incidents. In one on August 9th, he was involved in a scuffle on Canal Street with several anti-Castro Cubans and was arrested. The Warren Commission had concluded from this and other evidence that Oswald was a dedicated communist who had joined the Fair Play for Cuba Committee to support Fidel Castro. I knew that Oswald had stamped the 544 camp address only on his public handouts of August 9th. It no longer appeared on any subsequent pamphlets he gave out. There was something familiar about the building, so I went around the corner to the other entrance. There I found myself looking at what had been, in 1963, the entrance to the upstairs private detective office of Guy Bannister. So both entrances, 544 Camp and 531 Lafayette, led to the same place. And curiously, the name of Guy Bannister, which had come up 3 years before, had surfaced again. Bannister had died in 1964, about 9 months after the assassination. But now it occurred to me why 544 Camp Street appeared on Oswald's material for only one day. Somebody, presumably Bannister, had stopped Oswald from using the address on later circulars. Guy Bannister would not have been enthusiastic about Oswald stamping his address on pro-Castro literature. Even though he was no longer in the FBI, Bannister had shared the sentiments of J. Edgar Hoover. He was heavily involved in anti-communist endeavors of all kinds. Knowing now that Guy Bannister's office was the headquarters out of which Oswald had operated, I began to grasp some of the things I had learned about the so-called Marxist-oriented pamphleteer. Whenever Oswald was going to hand out pro-Castro leaflets, for example, he regularly had gone to a local employment office and hired men to help him in his leafleting work. This recruitment method was highly improbable for a true Marxist group, since most had no money. Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, by contrast, had no apparent members other than himself, but enough money that it could hire people. This was the first evidence I encountered that Lee Oswald had not been a communist or a Marxist of any kind. What appeared to be considerably more probable, now that I had seen the setup at 544 Camp, was that Guy Bannister, or someone associated with him, had been using Oswald as an agent provocateur. If Oswald had been working that summer under Bannister, that would help explain some other oddities I discovered in my reading. When Oswald was arrested on August 9th and brought to the police station, he immediately asked to see an FBI agent. Oswald was separated from the other arrested men and brought into a private room. There he talked with Special Agent John Quigley of the local bureau office. This is contrary to standard bureau procedure. Such special treatment for a vociferous communist seemed inexplicable, unless Oswald was actually working with Guy Bannister, a former high-ranking FBI official who could have easily arranged it. About a week later, someone arranged for Oswald to participate in a radio debate on station WDSU. The subject was capitalism versus communism. Oswald portrayed himself on the program as a Marxist. After Kennedy's assassination, copies of the tape were sent to members of Congress as proof positive that a communist had killed the president. If Oswald was working under Bannister's direction, neither his pamphleting nor his radio debating were intended to convert anyone to the cause of Marxism. Rather, they were designed to create a highly visible public profile for Lee Harvey Oswald as a communist. Across from Bannister's office was the post office building housing the New Orleans Secret Service operation. And upstairs was the New Orleans headquarters of the Office of Naval Intelligence. Was it just coincidence that Guy Bannister, who had begun his career with ONI, had chosen an office right across the street from his old employers? Just as much a coincidence, I suppose, as the location of his previous private detective office, directly across the street from the New Orleans offices of the CIA and the FBI. It seemed to me incongruous that, with Oswald planning to kill the president, he chose the U.S. government's intelligence complex as the place to spend his spare time until his strike. I have been left with a troubling conclusion. That was the possibility of a pre-existing relationship between the man portrayed as the lone killer of President Kennedy and the intelligence community of the United States government. It was now 1966, and I had to go back to where I had started 3 years ago when the president was killed. I had to locate the original source of the information that David Ferry had driven to Texas on the day of the assassination. That source was Jack Martin, the victim of Guy Bannister's pistol whipping. Within a few hours, we had brought Martin in. He was a private detective whom I had known casually as far back as my days as an assistant DA. I said, "The police report says the reason Bannister beat you was you had an argument over telephone bills." Now, does a simple argument over phone bills sound like a believable explanation to you? Martin said, "Nah, we'd both been drinking. Bannister was in a mean mood, then all of a sudden he accused me of going through his private files. And that really ticked me off. I blew up and told him he'd better not talk to me like that. I told him I remembered the people I had seen around the office that summer. And that's when he hit me. Pulled out that big magnum and slammed me on the side of the head with it." "And just who were the people you'd seen in the office that summer?" "They're all those Cubans coming and going and other characters. And there was David Ferry. But you know about him by now." "Was Ferry there very often?" "Often. He practically lived there."
"And Lee Harvey Oswald?"
"Yeah, he was there too. Sometimes he'd be meeting with Guy Bannister with the door shut. Other times he'd be shooting the bull with Dave Ferry. But he was there all right."
"So just what was going on at Bannister's office?"
He said, "I can't go into that stuff at all. I think I better go."
"Hold on, Jack. What's the problem with our going into what was happening at Bannister's office?"
"What's the problem? The problem is that we're going to bring the goddamn federal government down on our backs. Do I need to spell it out? I could get killed and so could you."
Even after talking to Martin, it was still too early for me to create a formal investigative team to look into the assassination. Informally, I brought on Louis Ivan, easily the brightest of the police assigned to my office. I gave Ivan the assignment of developing all possible information about David Ferry. I had already brought in Frank Klein, my chief assistant DA. A week after my interview with Jack Martin, Frank Klein laid in front of me a photostat of the front page of the New Orleans Times-Picayune dated Thursday, August 1, 1963. The story said that, quote, "More than a ton of dynamite, 20 bomb casings, napalm, and other devices were seized by FBI agents in a resort area in St. Tammany Parish," end quote. The story went on to say that materials were seized in connection with an investigation of an effort to, quote, "carry out a military operation against a country with which the United States is at peace," end quote. The next day's follow-up story said that the owners of the house had no knowledge munitions were stored there, that they had loaned the house to a Cuban they knew only as Jose Juarez, as a favor to friends of theirs in Cuba. So, some ammunition had been found north of Lake Pontchartrain. The local FBI chief had not indicated a specific country, and there had been no arrests. I pushed the news story off to the side. Later, I would recall having almost tossed away a major lead. Soon we got a new break. Guy Bannister's widow unexpectedly agreed to grant us an interview. but she never knew much about what Guy Bannister had been doing at his office. She did tell us that his files had been carted off by federal agents within hours of his death. And we found out the state police had taken a box with index cards to the files. 3 years later, only a handful of the index cards remained, but what did spoke volumes. Bannister's files had headings such as Dismantling of U.S. Defenses, Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Italy, U.S. bases dismantled in General Assembly of the United Nations, Latin America, missile bases dismantled in Turkey and Italy. Instead of the typical fare one would expect to find in a private detective's files, Guy Bannister's files had been loaded with international defense data. Meanwhile, Jack Martin had resurfaced. I showed him the two news stories about the munitions raid by the FBI. I said, Jack, is this part of the business Guy Bannister was involved in? He responded, yeah, that was part of Bannister's deal, but he doesn't say a damn thing about the main raid and all the Cubans who were arrested. And so Jack Martin started to talk. The talks took place over a period of weeks. The actual FBI raid included not only the ammunition described in the news story, but also the nearby undescribed training camp. At this camp, trainees had been arrested, 9 of them Cuban exiles and 2 of them Americans. This group, later described as the Poncha Train 11, was preparing for future CIA-sponsored attacks on Cuba. The FBI raid had come in response to pressure from President Kennedy, who wanted the Bureau to stop the CIA's unending violations of the Neutrality Act. The effect of the FBI's public pronouncements about the raid was to protect and continue to conceal the curious activities at Bannister's office. The Bannister apparatus, as Martin described it, was part of a supply line that ran along the Dallas-New Orleans-Miami corridor. These supplies consisted of arms and explosives for use against Castro's Cuba. We later learned from one of the participants, a former CIA employee named Gordon Novel, about one such mission to acquire combat ammunition. David Ferry, one of the leaders of the local Cuban Revolutionary Front, and a handful of others from Bannister's office, drove down one night to the blimp air base at Houma, Louisiana. They entered one of the Schlumberger Corporation's explosives bunkers and removed landmines and grenades stored there. The Schlumberger Corporation serviced oil producers. It had been a supporter of the French OAS, which attempted to assassinate President Charles de Gaulle several times in the 50s and 60s for his role in freeing Algeria. The CIA, which was also supportive of the French OAS generals, had supplied Schlumberger with ammunition. This operation at Houma was simply getting its ammunition back. Bannister's operation also included the processing and handling of anti-Castro trainees passing through the city, some wearing green combat outfits with black boots and others wearing civilian clothes, arrived and departed in a steady stream. And all of this played out directly across the street from the offices of the ONI and the Secret Service, with the CIA housed nearby. It seemed to my team that the parade in and out of Guy Bannister's place would have been hard for these intelligence agencies to ignore, especially David Ferry, the adventurer with his crudely cut homemade wig and large grease paint eyebrows which never quite matched. Ferry suffered from alopecia, a rare disease that renders its victims completely hairless. It strains credibility to think that the Secret Service and ONI agents across the street did not see the movement of ammunition boxes to and from Bannister's office. Rifles, hand grenades, landmines, whatever had been collected for the secret war against Cuba. I obtained a copy of the Secret Service's report of its investigation of Bannister's office. The report's synopsis stated, quote, extensive investigation conducted thus far has failed to establish that the Fair Play for Cuba Committee had offices at 544 Camp Street. It has likewise been impossible to find anyone who recalls ever seeing Lee Harvey Oswald at this address, End quote. That was the sum and substance of the Secret Service's extensive investigation. There had been the Lee Harvey Oswald who, the government told us, was close to being the most rabid communist since Lenin. On the other hand, at our very doorstep, there had been a flesh-and-blood Oswald. This Oswald used as the headquarters for his pamphleteering the office of Guy Bannister, formerly of the FBI and ONI. And Oswald had been on a first-name basis with the anti-communist soldier of fortune, David Ferry, a man who had trained anti-Castro pilots for the Bay of Pigs, and who by 63 was giving guerrilla training to more Cuban exiles for some new venture against the island. Which one had been the real Lee Harvey Oswald? And just how deep had his commitment to Marxism been? That's what I was after. I began by looking at the testimonies surrounding El Toro Marine Base in California, where Oswald was stationed from 58 to 59. Of all the Marines, Nelson Delgado had lived closest to Oswald, so I headed straight for his testimony. It said that Delgado had no recollection whatever of Oswald's Marxist leanings. He also volunteered that Oswald had been terrible when it came to shooting a rifle and had difficulty meeting the minimum standard for qualifying. Delgado's views were shared by all but one who knew Oswald in the military, and that was Kerry Thornley, whose testimony was heard directly by the Warren Commission and subsequently was given great attention by the media. In the commission volumes, it was separated from the affidavits of the other Marines. This made me wonder if the Warren Commission had actually read the other Marines' affidavits, which overwhelmingly contradicted Thornley's claims. I thought about the Russian examination Oswald had taken at El Toro and began to look into his earlier Marine service for hints of possible intelligence work. By now I knew that Oswald possessed the characteristics the military looks for in its intelligence recruits. He was from a military family. One brother also had joined the Marines, another the Air Force. He was very closed-mouthed by nature and was well above average in intelligence. Oswald's assignment at Japan's Atsugi Air Base in 57 was an anti-aircraft unit. It required a highly classified security clearance, since the duty involved guarding a U-2 hangar. Next, I decided to focus my research on Oswald's movements immediately after he left the Marines. In the summer of 59, Oswald applied for and received a premature discharge from the Marine Corps. He cited his mother's physical hardships requiring his presence and care. After spending 3 days with his mother in Fort Worth, he left for New Orleans. Next came Oswald's journey out of New Orleans to the Soviet Union. His departure for Europe was by ship. His steamship ticket had been obtained at the Likes office of New Orleans International Trademart. Trademart was directed by Clay Shaw, whose name we would come to know only too well later in the investigation. Oswald sailed to England and flew from there to Helsinki on October 9th, 1959. Much later in 1978, James A. Wilcott, a former CIA finance officer, told the House Select Committee on Assassinations that Oswald had been recruited from the military by the CIA. He said, quote, "It was with the express purpose of a double agent assignment in the USSR," end quote. Back in 1966, such clear-cut testimony was not in the public record, but the double agent scenario had crossed my mind. The CIA, of course, had denied from the beginning that Oswald was ever employed by the agency. After Oswald arrived in Moscow by train from Finland on October 16, 1959, he engaged in a series of contacts with Soviet officials. The initial Soviet response was cautious, even though he brought with him knowledge of American anti-aircraft technology. The newcomer underwent extensive interrogation. After 2 weeks, Oswald made a dramatic appearance at the American embassy. He flamboyantly handed over his passport and a letter saying his allegiance was with the USSR. He also announced that he had told Soviet officials he would give them information about the Marine Corps and the highly secret radar operations. Oswald's dramatic defection hit the world media. Then, after 15 months in the Soviet Union, Oswald applied at the American Embassy in Moscow to return to the United States. The following month, he met Marina Prushakova, the niece of a lieutenant colonel in the KGB. In April 1961, less than 2 months after they had met, they were married. Surprisingly, neither government objected to Oswald's return to America or to Marina's coming with him. The State Department approved Oswald's return, although it could have easily refused the defector's request. The department's report stated that Oswald had not expatriated himself by his actions upon arriving in the Soviet Union. It added that there was no indication in FBI reports that Oswald was a communist, and it authorized the American Embassy in Moscow to lend him money on behalf of state for his return. Oswald, his wife Marina, and their Russian-born daughter arrived in the United States in June of 62. The government never prosecuted Oswald for his alleged defection. Upon their arrival, Oswald and family immediately moved to Fort Worth. There he worked at the Leslie Welding Company until October 7, 1962, when Baron George de Morenschild and his wife came over from Dallas to spend the evening as guests of Lee and Marina at their modest apartment. It was plain that Oswald and the Baron had mutual interests, not yet officially revealed, that caused them to find each other's company interesting. The following day, Lee packed up and moved to Dallas, 30 miles away, where de Morenschild lived. In less than a month, Oswald had obtained a job at Yeager Stovall Childs. That company was under a contract with the Pentagon and was engaged in the production of charts and maps for military use. This job required an extremely high security classification. Lee Harvey Oswald not only was given the job within 1 week of his arrival in Dallas, but also had access to a variety of classified materials. Despite his defection, Oswald and his family were welcomed with open arms by the anti-communist white Russian community of Dallas. These were the people who helped Lee and Marina find lodging and saw to it that there was sufficient milk for the baby. I discovered that Oswald's most frequent associate in Dallas was George de Morenschild. He'd been in the United States longer than most of the white Russians. The Baron was a consulting geologist and a member of the exclusive Dallas Petroleum Club, with extremely affluent contacts in the business world. Among his close friends, one of the more interesting was the president of Schlumberger Corporation. And Schlumberger's Houma operation was the place where the ammo cache had been retrieved by the CIA. The Baron, obviously a capitalist and an anti-communist, was the closest friend in Dallas of the young man whom the Warren Commission had found to have a commitment to Marxism. Of the many anti-communist Russians welcoming the Oswalds, only Anna and Theophil Meller had any serious reservations about the couple. This was because Anna, while visiting the Oswalds' apartment, had seen a copy of Karl Marx's Das Kapital on a table. Her husband later called the FBI and reported the fact. He was informed by the Bureau spokesman that Oswald was, quote, all right, end quote. The Warren Commission handled this potential problem of the FBI's protection of Oswald with its usual elan. It simply did not call Meller as a witness or even take his affidavit. Oswald's treatment following his return, both by the intelligence community and by dedicated anti-communists, led me to a single, unavoidable conclusion. While in the Soviet Union, Oswald was engaged in an intelligence mission for the U.S. government. Although most of the government was aware that the CIA had been operating domestically for a long time, I knew that the agency kept such operations clandestine. At the time, I could not be sure just who was guiding Lee Oswald and the exiles surrounding him. But now, with the benefit of hindsight, it seems pretty evident. There is now little doubt that George de Morenschildt had been operating under deep cover as an agent of the CIA. It is equally apparent that his assignment was to bring Oswald from Fort Worth to Dallas and thereafter to serve as one of his, quote, babysitters, end quote. A babysitter is the term used by American intelligence to describe the agent assigned to protect or otherwise see to the general welfare of a particular individual. My conclusion that de Morenschildt was an unwitting babysitter for Oswald came when I established phone contact with the Baron. Both de Morenschildt and his wife were positive that the shooting of the president, or even of a rabbit for that matter, simply was not in Lee Oswald's makeup. They were vigorous in their insistence that Oswald had been the scapegoat. I was particularly struck by the depth of their unhappiness at what had been done not only to John Kennedy, but to Lee Oswald as well. George de Morenschildt committed suicide in March 1977, just hours after arranging to meet an investigator from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Spring of 1963 arrived, and Lee Oswald left Dallas for New Orleans. His wife and daughter arrived there shortly afterwards. By May 9th, Oswald had a job in New Orleans at the Riley Coffee Company, just on the other side of the post office building from Guy Bannister's office. Among the Warren Commission exhibits were dozens of job applications that Lee Oswald apparently filed at one place after another before landing his job at Riley. Oswald's familiar chicken scrawl handwriting was apparent at first glance on every application. However, the more I pored over these applications, the more puzzled I was. On every one of them, the applicant had listed his height as 5'9". The problem was that Lee Oswald happened to have been 5'11" tall. Why, then, should he repeatedly be writing down his height as 5'9"? There was a connection between Oswald's height discrepancy and the lead my investigator Lou Ivan picked up. Evidently, Oswald had visited the Bolton Ford dealership on North Claiborne Avenue. As we later learned from car salesman Fred Sewell and Oscar DeLatte, two men claiming to represent an organization called Friends of Democratic Cuba arrived at the Bolton dealership on January 20, 1961. This was only 3 months before the abortive Bay of Pigs attempt to invade Cuba. One of the two would-be customers was a powerfully built Latin with a thick neck and a distinct scar over his left eyebrow. The other was a thin, young Anglo-Saxon who obviously was in charge. The two men indicated that they wanted to buy 10 Ford pickup trucks. They wanted a bid from Bolton Ford on the price. The Latin identified himself as Joseph Moore, but said the bid had to be in the name of Oswald. The young Anglo-Saxon confirmed this, explaining that Oswald was his name and that he was the one with the money. Instead of asking the buyers to sign, the lad himself printed the name Oswald on the form. The real Lee Oswald was in the Soviet Union that day and would be for more than another year. Following President Kennedy's assassination, Sewell and DeLatte remembered Oswald's visit to their dealership and called the FBI. When FBI agents saw the bid form with Oswald's last name on it, they picked it up carefully with solenoid tongs. After hearing of the Bolton Ford incident, I became very interested in Friends of Democratic Cuba. I obtained a copy of its articles of incorporation. There, among the organization's incorporators, was the ubiquitous name of Guy Bannister. I pondered the implications of this staggering information. In the very month that John Kennedy was inaugurated, an intelligence project being run by Guy Bannister was using the name Oswald in bidding for pickup trucks for apparent use in the Bay of Pigs invasion. More important, the thin young American who had done the bidding either knew Lee Oswald or knew his name. In either case, Oswald was far off in the Soviet Union at the time. It had always puzzled me why Oswald had left Dallas in April 1963 to spend the summer in New Orleans, only to return to Dallas again in October. But given what I had learned, this began to make sense. If Oswald was being set up as a communist scapegoat, his association in Dallas with the anti-communist white Russians had to be severed. Likewise, a summer of ostentatiously handing out pro-Castro leaflets in New Orleans reinforced the image of a crazed communist assassin. In the intelligence community, there is a term for this kind of manipulated behavior designed to create a desired image. Sheep dipping. It seemed to me that Oswald had been in New Orleans to be sheep dipped under the guidance of Guy Bannister, and that he had been sent back to Dallas when the mission was accomplished. To see if I was on the right track, I studied more closely Oswald's return to Dallas and his last 2 months before the assassination. On September 23, 1963, a pregnant Marina Oswald and her daughter left New Orleans. They were driven to Dallas by Mrs. Ruth Payne. Lee Oswald left approximately a day later. Lee and Marina Oswald had met Ruth Payne in early 63 at a party in Dallas to which George de Morenschildt and his wife had brought them. I found that Ruth Payne was the wife of Michael Payne, an engineering designer who did highly classified work for Bell Helicopter, a major Defense Department contractor. Ruth Payne was a rangy, intelligent woman with widespread interests, among them the Russian language, which she had learned to speak quite well. Her father had been employed by the Agency for International Development, regarded by many as a source of cover for the CIA. Her brother-in-law was employed by the same agency. It was on Ruth Payne's way back from a long vacation, during which she had visited her in-laws from Washington, D.C., that she made the stop in New Orleans to pick up Marina and her daughter for their return to Dallas. When they reached Dallas, Mrs. Payne made them at home in her house in Irving, a Dallas suburb. She and her husband, Michael, had separated temporarily, so there was sufficient space for guests. On October 4th, Lee also returned to Dallas. He spoke of having been in Houston looking for work. 10 days later, Ruth Payne obtained an interview for him, and he got the job at the Texas School Book Depository. As a routine matter, I wanted to examine the income tax returns of Ruth and Michael Payne, but I was told that they had been classified as secret. While his wife and daughter stayed with Ruth Payne, Lee Oswald, according to the government, was in Mexico City. Allegedly, he was contacting the Soviet and Cuban embassies and making himself quite visible. Evidence which came out years after my official investigation was over suggests to me that Lee Harvey Oswald had not been in Mexico City at all. Rather, it strongly suggests that Lee Oswald was impersonated in Mexico City. Edwin Juan Lopez, who ran the House Committee's extensive Mexico City investigation, believes the same. This would be consistent with other impersonations of Oswald in New Orleans and Dallas that were carried out in an effort to set him up as a patsy. In late September, another such incident occurred, this time in Dallas. A Leon Oswald appeared at the home of Sylvia Odio with two Spanish-speaking guerrilla types. One of the two later phoned her, telling her of how crazy Leon was and how he wanted to kill the president. The following month in Dallas, Mrs. Lovell Penn found three men firing a rifle on her property and chased them away. After they left, she found an empty cartridge case. It bore the label Mannlicher Carcano, the archaic and almost useless rifle which, the Warren Commission would announce, Oswald used at Dealey Plaza. In early November, a young man using the name of Lee Oswald applied for a job at a parking lot at the Southland Hotel. During the course of his conversation with the manager, he asked if there was a good view of downtown Dallas from the building. These scenarios were about as subtle as roaches trying to sneak across a white rug. But the most preposterous incident of the bunch took place one afternoon in early November of 1963. A young man arrived at the downtown Lincoln Mercury dealership, which happened to be just across the way from where the assassination would soon occur. He announced his intention of buying a car. The salesman, Albert Bogard, showed him a red Mercury Comet. In short order, they were test driving it along the Stemmons Freeway, the customer at the wheel. After they got on the freeway, he revved up the speed to 60 and 70 miles an hour. As the salesman afterwards told his boss, he drove like a madman. When they got back, the customer seemed unhappy upon learning about a required $300 down payment. Eugene Wilson, another salesman, heard him say, quote, "Maybe I'm going to have to go back to Russia to buy a car," end quote. The man then told Bogard that he would be back to get the car in a couple of weeks, that he had some money coming in. He gave his name as Lee Oswald. All these heavy-handed scenes confirmed my initial instinct that someone had been impersonating Oswald. And now the reason was obvious. A trail of phony, incriminating evidence had been carefully laid down prior to the execution of the president, leading to Oswald as the scapegoat. When had the manipulation begun? Were there some early signs? My mind went back to El Toro Marine Base in California and Kerry Thornley, the one Marine whose testimony about Oswald was so different from that of the other Marines. Thornley had arrived in New Orleans as far back as 1961, and again in 1963, finally leaving the city only a few days after Kennedy's murder. Barbara Reed, a longtime French Quarter resident who had known both Thornley and Oswald, described seeing them together on several occasions at a combination restaurant in the French Quarter. We were eager to talk to Kerry Thornley, but he was not an easy man to locate. It took us a lot of legwork and more than a year to do it. I had a grand jury subpoena served on him, and a few weeks later we had Kerry Thornley visiting the Criminal District Court building in New Orleans. He was surprisingly candid about having met both Guy Bannister and David Ferry while in New Orleans, although he described these meetings as brief. He denied having met Oswald during that period when both were in New Orleans. I had learned that virtually all of the young men connected with Guy Bannister's operation carried a box key for the Lafayette Square post office. It was probably for receiving mailed instructions from their intelligence case officers or to provide an explanation for their presence in the ONI building. When I asked Thornley why he carried such a box key, he replied that he had lived just across the street at the Fox Hotel. It was a matter of convenience. Surprisingly, Thornley volunteered that he'd been writing a novel inspired by Lee Oswald, which he finished 9 months before the assassination. Not many individuals were writing books inspired by Oswald, at least not before the president's murder. I developed an interest in Thornley because I suspected he could have been the man who used the name Oswald at the Bolton Ford Company. In January of 61, Thornley bore a striking resemblance to Oswald. They were approximately the same height and slight build, both brown-haired, and had similar facial features. When the Warrant Commission counsel had asked Thornley how tall Oswald was, he had said, quote, "Maybe 5'5". Shorter than me, I'm 5'10", end quote. But Oswald was the taller of the two. Why then had Thornley testified that Oswald was 6 inches shorter than he really was? Unless Thornley had been Oswald's impersonator and feared discovery in front of the commission. At some unknown time, apparently when Oswald was not at his Neely Street address in Dallas, a young man of Oswald's build, wearing a pistol on his hip, had posed for several photographs in the backyard. In one picture, he held aloft a rifle and a copy of the communist paper, The Daily Worker. In the second picture, he held the rifle and a copy of The Militant, also a left-wing newspaper. These incriminating pictures purporting to be Oswald had been found in Ruth Payne's garage. When one of the pictures exploded on the cover of Life magazine, some people decided the case against Lee Oswald was indisputable. At first glance, the pictures appeared to be of Lee Oswald. However, after study, it was apparent that in each picture, Oswald's face did not precisely fit the neck and body. Furthermore, the facial portrait of Oswald was exactly the same one in each photograph, whereas the posture and the distance from the camera differed. In addition to that, using the length of Oswald's face as the standard of measurement, one of the bodies in one picture was clearly taller than the corresponding body in the other picture. It is very rare, if not unheard of, in the annals of assassination for the assassin to be to provide so much incriminating evidence against himself in advance. It seemed plain enough to me that this was just another part of the process of setting up the patsy. Thornley had told me that he returned from his summer in California by way of Mexico City. This happened to be very close to the time that the Warren Commission said Oswald was in Mexico. By November 1963, according to his own account, Thornley was living in a New Orleans apartment he rented from John Spencer. We located Spencer, who turned out to be a friend of Clay Shaw's. Spencer told us that several days after the assassination, Thornley had gone to Washington. In the mid-70s, I learned that after his Warren testimony, Thornley had returned to California, where he and John Roselli happened to become friends. Roselli had been one of the mobsters with whom the CIA had developed a relationship during its pre-Castro activities in Cuba. After the Cuban Revolution, Roselli's assignment from the agency was to assassinate Fidel Castro. Roselli was not as closed-mouthed about his mission as the agency would have liked. He testified before a Senate committee about it. Not long afterwards, his murdered remains were found in an oil drum floating off Florida. The Warren Commission had taken testimony from one Dean Andrews, a roly-poly lawyer who spoke in a hippie argot all his own. He admitted to the commission that on the day after the assassination, while he was a hospital patient, he was called on the phone and asked to fly to Dallas and be Lee Oswald's lawyer. He gave the caller's name as Clay Bertrand. Now, in early 67, we learned that Clay Bertrand was actually Clay Shaw, the distinguished director of the International Trade Mart in New Orleans, and a civic leader of note. But we had no inkling that Clay Shaw was much bigger and more powerful than his New Orleans persona indicated. It was not until well after the Shaw trial that we discovered Shaw's extensive international role as an employee of the CIA. Shaw's secret life as an agency man in Rome, trying to bring fascism back to Italy, was exposed in articles in the Italian press. The CIA, which apparently had been conducting its own foreign policy for some time, had begun a project in Italy as far back as the early 60s. The organization, named the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, the World Trade Center, had initially been formed in Montreal, then moved to Rome in 61. Among the members of its board of directors was one Clay Shaw from New Orleans. The Centro opened an additional office in Switzerland. The stories in the Italian press, and a book published later, made it clear that Centro's activities served the paramilitary right in Europe, including Italian fascists, the American CIA, and similar interests. The Italian government expelled the Centro from Italy for subversive intelligence activity. Subsequently, Centro was also booted out of Switzerland and set up headquarters in Johannesburg. I began to wonder, had Oswald actually shot the president at all? I studied the statements of witnesses who claimed to have observed unusual activity in the book depository and other buildings clustered behind the president. The more I read, the more my doubts grew. About 15 minutes before the motorcade arrived, Arnold Roland, a student, and his wife Barbara were across from Dealey Plaza. Arnold glanced up at the book depository. At the easternmost end of the sixth floor, he noticed a dark-skinned man whom he described as an elderly Negro. However, at the westernmost end of the sixth floor, he saw a man with a rifle in his hands. At that moment, Barbara Roland was preoccupied by a man having an epileptic seizure in the plaza directly across from them. By the time Arnold got his wife's attention, the man with the rifle had stepped away. Arnold testified that when he described the presence of the dark-skinned man to FBI agents, quote, "They told me it didn't have any bearing on the case," end quote. Carolyn Walther, employed at the nearby Dow Tech's building, watched the ambulance arrive for the seizure victim and happened to glance toward the depository. There she saw a man with a rifle on one of the upper floors. Mrs. Walther said that the rifle was different from any she had ever seen and had an unusually short barrel. The man holding it was wearing a white shirt, was either blonde or had light-colored hair. In the same window, just to his left, she could see another man standing erect. He appeared to be wearing a brown suit. Then the motorcade arrived and drew her attention. It did not occur to her to glance up at the window again, not even after the shooting began. She was not called to testify by the Warren Commission. Tony Henderson of Dallas was waiting for the parade on the east side of Elm. She noticed two men. She said one was possibly a Mexican, but could have been a Negro. Mrs. Henderson was unable to describe the other man. Testifying before the Warren Commission was 16-year-old Amos Ewens. He described having waved at the president as the long convertible made its leftward 120-degree turn onto Elm. He happened to glance upward at the book depository and saw what appeared to be a pipe sticking out of a window. After the shooting began, Ewens was able to see the trigger and the stock of the rifle. He also noticed that the man doing the shooting had a distinct bald spot on his head. In his commission testimony, Ewens indicated that he could not be certain whether the man was white or Negro. In any case, Ewens' observation of an apparently dark-skinned man with a bald spot on his head seemed to coincide with Arnold Roland's observation of an elderly Negro. In each instance, the man was occupying the easternmost window, the assassin's lair, where Oswald was supposed to have been when the parade arrived. Roger Craig was honored in 1960 for his performance as a Dallas deputy sheriff. He remembered that a few minutes after the assassination, he observed the Dallas police questioning a Latin man on Elm Street. As Craig recalled it, the police were frustrated when the man did not answer their questions because he could not speak English, so they released him. Some minutes afterwards, Craig saw a Nash Rambler station wagon pull up in front of the depository. He recognized the driver as the Latin man who had just been released by the police. Before he could do anything, a young white man, whom Craig later identified as Lee Oswald, came running down from in front of the depository, jumped in, and the station wagon tore off. This time, Craig got a closer look at the Latin man. He described the man as being not merely dark-skinned, but a Negro. Later, Deputy Sheriff Buddy Walters drove out to the Payne residence in the suburb of Irving. He confirmed that Mrs. Ruth Payne, the woman Marina had stayed with when she first moved to Dallas, did have a Nash Rambler station wagon with a luggage rack on top, as Craig had observed. There is no record that Captain Fritz or the Dallas Homicide Unit ever followed up this lead. In fact, Fritz later denied that Craig had been at police headquarters or had told him about the Nash Rambler. However, a news photo turned up 6 years after the assassination in the autobiography of Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry. It clearly shows Craig at police headquarters, corroborating Craig's story. all the statements that formed a composite of the depository's sixth floor just before and during the assassination added up to at least three different men, two white and one very possibly of Latin origin. After reading the statements of these eyewitnesses, I knew that Lee Oswald could not have shot John Kennedy from the assassin's lair as the Warren Commission claimed. Unlike the man who was observed shooting from the lair, Oswald did not have a bald spot, nor was he dark-skinned, nor Latin. However, that description reminded me of the anti-Castro Cuban exiles who were constantly traipsing through Guy Bannister's office. In addition to the eyewitness descriptions, other evidence pointed away from Oswald. A great deal of confusion surrounded this second-rate Italian rifle. Officer Seymour Weitzman, part of the Dallas police search team, later described the discovery of the rifle on the afternoon of November 22nd. He stated that it had been so well hidden under boxes of books that the officers stumbled over it many times before they found it. Officer Weitzman also operated a sporting goods store and was recognized as an authority on weapons. Consequently, Dallas Homicide Chief Will Fritz, who was on the scene, asked him the make of the rifle. Weitzman identified it as a 7.65 Mauser, a highly accurate German-made weapon. Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig was also there and later recalled the word Mauser inscribed in the metal of the gun. Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade told the media that the weapon found was a Mauser. There were other problems with the story that the Mannlicher Carcano had been the murder weapon. For instance, no ammunition clip was ever found. The clip is the device that feeds the cartridges into the rifle's firing chamber. Without such a clip, the cartridges have to be loaded by hand, making impossible the fast shooting Oswald was alleged to have done. The Warren Commission skirted this problem by never confronting that fact. Complicating the matter even further, the Mannlicher Carcano triumphantly produced as the assassin's rifle was found to have a badly misaligned sight. Despite these problems, the official position was that the rifle was the Mannlicher Carcano. The Mauser disappeared forever shortly after it reached Captain Fritz. But even this revision of the official story did not explain the third rifle. A film taken by Dallas Cinema Associates showed a scene of the book depository shortly after the assassination. Police officers on the fire escape were bringing down a rifle from the roof above the sixth floor with the tender care you might give an infant. When I saw the film, I noted that this rifle had no sight mounted on it. Thus, it could not have been either the Carcano or the vanished Mauser, both of which had sights. Moreover, Oswald had been seen in the lunchroom down on the second floor of the depository less than 2 minutes after the shooting. He not only had appeared composed and relaxed, but was drinking a Coke which he had bought from the vending machine. It would have been impossible for him to do the shooting, hide the rifle, run down four flights of stairs, and stop for a Coke, all in less than 2 minutes. But the most obvious and compelling piece of evidence exonerating Oswald was the nitrate test he was given that evening. Simply put, this test reveals deposits of nitrate on an individual's cheek when he or she has fired a rifle. The nitrate test results indicated that Lee Oswald had not fired a rifle on November 22, 1963. This fact was kept secret for 10 months. It was finally revealed in the Warren Commission report. After going over the government's own evidence, I realized that my earlier conclusion that Oswald had not been the lone killer of President Kennedy was not entirely correct. Clearly, there had been others involved in the shooting. But the truth was that Lee Oswald himself had not shot John Kennedy at all. Later, I uncovered the fact that the parade route had been altered by studying the front page of the Dallas Morning News. On it was a huge diagram of the motorcade's route, covering almost 5/6 of the page. According to the paper's diagram, the parade route came down Main, approaching Dealey Plaza. The diagram indicated that the president's parade was supposed to continue on Main Street through the center of Dealey Plaza as it headed for the Stemmons Freeway without ever leaving Main. But it didn't. The motorcade turned right on Houston and went down onto Elm. And the sweeping 120-degree left turn onto Elm had to slow the president's car down to about 10 miles per hour. When I told this to Chief Assistant D.A. Frank Klein, he said, "On the original route, they couldn't have hit Kennedy. Are you telling me that at the last moment they just moved the President of the United States off of his scheduled route to where the depository is? I haven't read a damn word about that anywhere. How can they keep something like that a secret? And where the hell were the Dallas police when they made that last-minute change in the route?" Where indeed? And the Secret Service, and the FBI. Frank asked, "Did the Dallas City Administration and Mayor Cabell have to be notified?" Then Frank grabbed the front page of the Dallas Morning News and pointed to the diagram. Was the Warren Commission blind? Didn't they see this? I pulled out a copy of the Dallas Morning News front page that had been introduced as a commission exhibit. On 5/6 of the page where the diagram of the motorcade route was supposed to be, there was nothing but a large square of solid gray. It was the official exhibit as seen by the Warren Commission. Waving the nearly blank exhibit, Frank asked, "And just what in the hell are we supposed to call this?" I replied, "This is what you call a coup d'etat." I'd asked my secretary to go to the library and research Dallas Mayor Earl Cabell. She returned with nothing on the mayor but material on a General Charles Cabell. He was the mayor's brother, and he had been deputy director of the CIA, from which position he had been fired by Kennedy. Cabell had been in charge of the agency's disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion. His subsequent hatred of John Kennedy became an open secret in Washington. In most countries, a powerful individual who had been in open conflict with a national leader, who was later assassinated, would receive at least a modicum of attention in the course of a posthumous inquiry. However, General Cabell was never even called as a witness before the Warren Commission. One reason may have been that the former CIA director, Alan Dulles, was the member of the Warren Commission who handled all leads relating to the agency. During the 9 years that Dulles had been CIA chief, General Cabell had been his deputy. Clinton was a rural hamlet in deep South Louisiana. Back in late summer, early autumn of 63, Lee Oswald had been seen in Clinton in the company of two older men. The descriptions of these men closely fit Clay Shaw and David Ferry. In Clinton, Oswald had applied for a job at the mental institution, and that would have been all that his sponsors needed for another touch of sheep dipping. A few weeks of menial work there would have been enough to complete the picture of Oswald wandering helplessly from one job to another, each more obscure than the last. Perhaps the most important result of the Clinton work was that we had succeeded in connecting David Ferry and Clay Shaw. Knowing that Shaw and Ferry were engaged in some clandestine association gave us a better chance to develop information. To investigate Shaw alone, a highly controlled, discreet man with powerful connections, would have been difficult. Now, however, we had found a handle on Shaw. His name was David Ferry. To track Ferry, I met with Ray Gill, one of the city's best trial lawyers. I was there because David Ferry had worked as a part-time investigator for Gill. Gill acknowledged that Ferry had used his phone to excess, running up long-distance charges. His secretary got me copies of his phone bills during the period in question. Secretary discovered that the bills were missing for the assassination month of November 1963. She had no idea who had removed them, but pointed out that Ferry still had access to the office files back then. The long-distance calls, other than the missing November 63 bills, had a remarkable diversity. The calls were not only to many domestic cities, but to such distant locales as Guatemala, Mexico, and Canada. Then I painstakingly collected and correlated all of the Warren Commission exhibits, listing phone calls connected with witnesses encountered by the federal investigation. I made a connection. A local telephone bill indicated that one of Ferry's calls had been made from New Orleans to Chicago. That led me to Gene Ossie. I found Gene Ossie of Chicago, Illinois, in an FBI report. It described how she had accompanied Lawrence V. Myers on a business trip to Dallas, where they arrived the evening of November 20th, 1963. In the report, Ossie stated that the next evening Myers took her to the Carousel Club, where he introduced her to Jack Ruby. Lee Oswald's New Orleans friend, Dave Ferry, had called Ossie's Chicago number. I wondered if Miss Ossie was later curious when Jack Ruby, her partner in casual conversation, killed Oswald 3 days later. Then in an FBI interview with Lawrence Myers, I found that she had become Jean West. Miss Ossie, or Miss West, or whatever her name was, never appeared before the Warren Commission or gave a deposition to commission lawyers. I did find a third FBI mention of the mystery woman, this time described as Jean West, in the same commission exhibits volume. However, it added no illumination. She was not asked whether she knew David Ferry or how he could have had access to the very phone number by which Lawrence Myers also later reached her. Nor did the report reveal a flicker of curiosity about her pre-assassination chat with Jack Ruby. The timing of this meeting with Jack Ruby was provocative enough. However, the constant changing of her name, which would confuse anyone who wanted to know about her, confirmed for me that something about her or her phone number was suspicious. As I puzzled over this perplexing problem, it suddenly occurred to me that I had stumbled across the use of a message center, a customary intelligence community device to thwart any attempts to trace phone calls. And this telephone number, or a message center, belonged to a mystery woman who was linked with Jack Ruby. About this time, in early 67, we had an unexpected lucky break. Dick Billings, an editor from Life magazine, arrived at the office. Top management at Life had concluded that President Kennedy's assassination had been a conspiracy and that my investigation was moving in the right direction. Billings suggested we work together. The offer came at a good time. I had been wanting to increase my stakeout coverage of David Ferry's home, but did not have the personnel to spare, particularly an expert photographer, which Life now supplied. Meanwhile, out at New Orleans Airport, investigator Lou Ivan had located a former airplane mechanic of Ferry's named Jimmy Johnson. He had persuaded Johnson to go back to work for Ferry and to keep contact with our office. This airport stakeout on Ferry produced an early dividend. Ferry told Johnson that a package would be arriving for him shortly. A white compact sports car would be parked in front of the airport administration building with the door unlocked. Ferry asked Johnson to check every 10 minutes to see if it arrived. When it did, he was to reach under the seat for a brown package, which he was to bring to Ferry. The package for Ferry contained cash. By serving a subpoena on Ferry's bank, we also learned that Ferry had deposited more than $7,000 in cash in the weeks immediately preceding Kennedy's death. Another Ferry lead yielded two new names, Dante Maraschini, who lived next door to Clay Shaw, and James Lou Allen, who once shared an apartment with Ferry. Sometime later, I wanted to talk to individuals of the Riley Coffee Company who had worked with Oswald. Dante Maraschini's name resurfaced with others who had left Riley within a few weeks after Oswald left. Five in all, including Maraschini and Lou Allen, all five of whom were currently working for NASA. Another individual we located who had met Clay Shaw through David Ferry was Raymond Brochiers. We caught up with Brochiers sometime after Ferry's death in '65. He corroborated the Shaw-Ferry connection, recalling one incident on a street corner when he was with Ferry. Shaw drove up in an imposing black car, handed Ferry a large brown envelope with money inside, some of which went to Brochiers. Over a period of months, Ferry got to know Brochiers better and told him that he had driven to Houston on the afternoon of the assassination. His assignment was to wait there until joined by two members of the assassination team from Dallas. The two were to arrive by plane, piloted by a man named Carlos. Ferry had been assigned to pick up the two members of the team and then fly them on to a more distant location. Ferry said that he had done everything he was supposed to, including going to the ice skating rink in Houston and waiting for Carlos. But Carlos failed to show up. Ferry never revealed to Brochiers who gave him his orders. As we gathered these statements from Brochiers and the other witnesses, we had no idea that Shaw and Ferry were aware of our investigation. And the two were continuing to meet and plan together in hopes of heading us off. But in September 1967, a man who had spent a number of evenings being courted for his services by Shaw and Ferry found his way to my office and gave an extensive statement about the pair's activities to Assistant D.A. Jim Alcock. Edward Whalen from Philadelphia was a professional criminal. He'd spent most of his adult life in the penitentiary. In early 1967, Ferry asked Whalen to come to New Orleans. Whalen met Ferry and a man named Clay Bertrand at the Absinthe House. Bertrand was the alias Clay Shaw used. Ferry told Whalen he and Shaw wanted someone killed. Shaw was going to advance $10,000 to Whalen before the job. After it was completed, Whalen would receive another $15,000. Shaw would provide him with a phony passport, and Ferry would fly him to Mexico. When Ferry told Whalen the district attorney Garrison was the man they wanted killed, Whalen said he wanted nothing to do with the deal. However, Whalen and Ferry had agreed to meet at the Absinthe House again the next night. From there, they went directly to Shaw's apartment on Dauphine Street. Shaw then turned to Whalen and continued to try to persuade him. Also, Ferry spoke of Lee Oswald for the first time. He said that Bertrand had done a lot for Oswald and that it was only because Oswald had fouled up that he was killed. Oswald was an agent of the CIA, Ferry claimed, and had received money from him and Shaw at one time. Whalen insisted he wanted nothing to do with the plan, and he left. I was surprised to learn that I had become a target for removal. Our investigation had spent months discovering numerous witnesses who had positively linked Shaw and Ferry together. We still did not know precisely what they had been up to. But if they had reached the point of hiring a hitman to kill me, it had to be something pretty heavy.